Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
With you at the Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and things to think about. And we have been presenting to you for a number of weeks now a series on human sexuality, the evolution of human sexuality. We are continuing that series again today. It seems endless, doesn't it, Roberta? In fact, there's no place to stop.
Well, of course. I mean, it's a very deep and provoking kind of topic.
And which of you, I mean, just talking about human evolution and human sexuality, I want to read to you from Thomas More. Thomas More wrote a book called The Soul of Sex. And he says, in order to discover the sublime joys of sex, we may have to develop a special kind of intelligence about the erotic life. As a therapist, he says, I found that one word characterizes most people's attitude towards their own sexuality. One word, confusion. They don't understand their attractions and desires. They feel generally that their sexual lives are and have always been a mess. They believe that they are blind and powerless in the face of passion. They sustain the hope that one day they will find sexual bliss, but so far that hope has not been realized. The only other thing that seems to confuse people as much as sexuality is love. Yep. There's another one that everybody kind of gets confused about. I read to you. From Noel Coward. I am no good at love. My heart should be wise and free. I kill the unfortunate golden goose wherever it may be, with over-articulate tenderness and too much intensity. I am no good at love. I batter it out of shape. Suspicion tears at my sleepless mind, and gibbering like an ape, I lay alone in the endless dark, knowing there is no escape. I am no good at love. When my easy heart I yield, wild words come tumbling from my mouth, which should have stayed concealed, and my jealousy turns a bed of bliss into a battlefield. I am no good at love. I betray it with little sins, for I feel the misery of the end in the moment that it begins, and the bitterness of the last goodbye is the bitterness that always wins. That's how many people feel about love. That's how people are confused about love, about sexuality, and that's why we're doing these programs. So we've brought to you human evolution, and then we've taken that and tracked it through the development of sexuality. We have upcoming programs. We want to talk, it's just amazing that we could do it. We want to talk about some of the hardware that goes with sexuality. We want to talk about just what people are built with. We want to be able to talk about that to people and say, here's what we know about this. I want to also be able to talk about the difference between eroticism and pornography. Did you know the word pornography, Roberta, is a combination of the word porn and graphy, and porn means prostitute, and graphy means to depict.
So, no, I didn't know.
Yeah, so pornography literally means to arouse sexually, in effect, as if to go to a prostitute. Mm. And then, meanwhile, eroticism, which is this great confusion, has a meaning to stimulate sexually. But it means in a more passive kind of way. The erotic stimulates you, but pornography turns you on.
See, the way we were in Europe growing up, what we learn is that eroticism is actually much more encompassing than just in reference to sexuality. Eroticism is any time we feel propelled beyond our limits to discover, to uncover things, and the pleasure of that discovery is erotic. But unfortunately, I don't know why in the English language it has become synonymous often with pornography or with the more unpleasant sides of sexuality.
The exploitive side of sexuality.
Right, whereas it does not, it is not seen, or when someone in Europe says erotic, that's not what comes to mind.
We are going to, those are future programs. Today, we want to talk about falling in love and being attracted. Here are the questions. Is it possible that the features which draw us to dates and mates appear to reflect reproductive and parenting potential? Is that all that it's about? Is falling in love this magical event, or is it in fact a way of just selectively trying to find someone who is going to give us the best genes so that we could reproduce? Are we really slaves to this? There are two theories about it. One is that the basis of it all is going to be that we're going to just find a mate, and that all our biological programming is going to send us to the most efficient mate, the most attractive, the one who could give us the best home. Women are attracted to older men who are successful. Men are attracted to younger women who are prettier. I mean, this is the basis of it. Is that all there is to it? And then another theory adds to that, that there are certain things from your early childhood family that will bring additional attraction to you. Like if daddy wore boots, you might find boots attractive. Or if mom had a certain smell, you might find that smell attractive. A perfume. Is it all biological? Is there such a thing as love? Let's take a look at the biological and the stuff that we come in with having to deal with attractiveness and love. If programmed, are we just programmed to find a specific thing? The elaborate human ritual of falling in love and selecting a mate is not only, you know, circumscribed by our social patterns, but by our brains as well, built into the brains.
Well, of course, you know, the first thing that happens when we see someone, we think that we respond by thinking something, but actually we don't. The first thing that happens between two people when they look at one another is actually something that happens below the consciousness level, and it happens automatically without them even knowing that it's happening. So the same thing is when we fall in love with someone. Often you'll hear that people cannot explain what happened. All of a sudden they see this person and they're struck. And certainly there is a whole lot of thoughts attached to that event. But if you look at what goes on in the body, what you'll find is that the brain is reacting all the way from the hypothalamus to the amygdala to all different parts of the brain. All of a sudden it goes in high gear, and it starts to produce more neurotransmitters, and it starts to give us a sense of being more alive. Perhaps people who attract us are people who engage us in a chemical sense to discover more than what we know already about ourselves.
Is it true that falling in love is like eating chocolate?
Well, or maybe vice versa. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, the chemicals that go on in our body, we find the chemicals of the chocolate seem to be trigger things in people that they find is identical to the chemicals to the response of falling in love.
Right. It stimulates the same brain centers, and it causes us to produce a similar soup of neurotransmitters and hormones. And so Yes, I mean, there is a chemistry to love. We all know that. And there's also an alchemy of love, which I think is what we really are talking about when we talk about attraction. Because after we meet a person that we fall in love with, we are forever different. There's an alchemy that happens whereby the chemistry that was before we met that person will never be again. We are forever different after we meet someone we fall in love with. So in a way, that person becomes a permanent piece, a permanent part of our, not only our mind and our hearts and our souls, but our bodies in a chemical sense. We accommodate that person. We accommodate the chemistry they have to suit and to match our own.
Pretty big statement. You know, Jeffrey Cowley, a scientist, he says that regardless of whether it's fair or unfair, logical or illogical, we find certain things more attractive than others. Then an MIT neuroscientist, Nancy Etcoff, said that the obsession with beauty has existed in every culture at every point in history, but like it or not, other members of the animal world appear to make rapid, unconscious visual assessments of other animals as well. So this attractive and what attracts us doesn't necessarily have to be beauty. Here's the fascinating thing. Thing about the babies, huh, Roberta?
Yeah.
It's shocking.
That really
and surprising.
Is. Yes.
Babies ranging from 3 to 6 months old would have pictures put in front of them of faces that adults had agreed with that were attractive down to the less attractive. The babies looked significantly longer at the photographs of the people that the adults judged as attractive.
So there is something in the face of a human being that, according to how the features are positioned, assembled, distributed, communicates not just to the intellect, but to the instinct, because babies, of course, in terms of intellect, a baby is not making any intellectual judgment or assessments when he or she looks at a face, right? It's just
they're not prejudiced. They haven't been taught.
Right.
You know, you got
there's no prejudice, exactly. So there are no limitations. There's no, and yet, so that says that what we consider attractive is not just a cultural thing, but it's a biological thing, because of course, for instance, symmetrical features in a face most likely are found in a person who is balanced and someone who has, let's say, unusual features could be the carrier of a genetic mutation. And now we don't know that on the intellectual level, but perhaps the brain is able to pick it up just by looking.
So basic attraction is going to go for symmetry of the two sides of the face, right? We want the eyes to look alike. We want the ears to look alike. We want them not to be skewed out of shape. What people prefer, they say that, you know, there are things about noses and there are things about signs of cleanliness.
Well,
good
sure.
Health in general.
Good health is a big attraction. And also, of course, signs of fertility, at least up to a certain age. Obviously, if you're, you know, 70 years old, maybe you have acquired a different taste and you're attracted to different things than when you are 30 years old. But when you're, let's say, from 20 to 40, probably signs of fertility are the most attractive. And those are, of course, different from male and female, because male and females look for different things in a mate. And even now, for instance, that women are so capable of supporting themselves and being economically successful and independent, well, there is still a trend whereby women tend to be attracted more to men that give off a sense of stability, security, and economic success. I mean, it's a stereotype, and I hate it when I speak by cliches, but as far and wide as we have read. This is confirmed everywhere. There are exceptions, granted, but more often than not, a woman will be attracted to a man who gives her a sense of security, and the man will be attracted to a woman who gives a sense of being nurturing and kind and friendly. Here's an interesting one, Armand. I was reading, and I was kind of realizing that that's the case, that it's interesting how friendliness in women is often interpreted by men who don't know them as a sign that they are sexually open or available. And often a woman could be friendly simply just to be, you know, a nice person, and not think that by being friendly she is conveying a message.
Yes, and here we are dealing with attraction, and you never know, and you don't know, and then we're going to talk about jealousy as well, and the evolution of jealousy, and what role that played. So we look for general signs of good health and facial symmetry, but then explain Lyle Lovett. You know, explain how that happens, how somebody with a specifically asymmetrical face could be found so attractive.
Well, could we explain it?
I can't.
I can try.
I can't by those basics, but, you know, then I could look at power, and I could look at success. So if he's attractive from the level of being powerful and successful.
But maybe that's exactly what we're saying, Armand, that for human beings, even though we do have certain criteria that seem to apply or all across the board because they convey biological messages, for human beings we go beyond those messages. There is something about a human being that transcends the biological signs of what's attractive. And there is a kind of attraction that comes from appreciating what's different and what's unique and what's genial and what's creative. And all of that, I think a face like Lyle Lovett is indicative of a certain kind of uniqueness that I think can be appreciated.
Based on evolutionary theory, then it should not be surprising that men find visual cues to attractiveness more relevant in selecting a mate than women do. The clearest feminine cue to men, and this is not to say that men are just stupid because this is what they're, this is a tendency. The tendency is to look for curving contours created by the contrast, get this, between the waist and the hips. Now, this is such an interesting thing, because what they did in the studies of attractiveness, it wasn't just the size of the waist, the size of the hips, the size of the bust. It wasn't that. It was the contrast between the waist and the hips.
And what's interesting is that fashion for women throughout history, if you look at the evolution of fashion, has always done whatever it can to put that in even more in evidence, with the skirts with the big bottoms and with the ways to make the breasts bigger and higher so that the waist is more visible,
and
as contrast, and the corsets, right.
Which so, were, you know, they would pull on until you couldn't breathe.
Yes, but what that does is it makes the waist smaller compared to the hips and breasts, and that's a sign of fertility, believe it or not. When the woman has that shape, which, Armand, oh my God, I hope that women I am thinking about are listening, because women today are tortured with the idea that they should be so thin, that there should be nothing there, that they should be just straight, there should be no curves.
Zero fat.
And in fact, when we look at the studies of what men like, men don't like that thinness, that is no fat anywhere, and that the woman thinks that she should look like. Men, straight across the board, when asked in a survey what they like, what attracts them, is the curves. So I wish that women would keep this in mind, because unfortunately they don't.
even if it's not to attract men, but just to think that the best way to go through life is, you know, to be thin as a rail, this idea of this fear of fat, this fear, this terror that people have. Whether or not it attracts the men, because some men like very, very thin women, I'm sure they do.
But I was just saying that women think that in order to be attractive, many women today, not always, not everywhere, but in the U.S. today, women think in order to be attractive, they have to be thin. Most women do. The younger they are, the more they think so. And this is not what surveys are showing.
And it's also not what nature designed. Fat is an essential quality. Fat carried in the hips and thighs, which creates feminine curves, represents the stored calories needed by a maturing female to sustain a pregnancy. So there's basically an attractiveness to the fat storage. You know, this is what's really...
Sure, and it makes sense in a biological sense, as you just explained. And also, as I was saying before, when you look at fashion, that's what fashion has done through the ages. It has put those parts of the woman's body more in a way that they're more visible by enlarging them, artificially enlarging them.
Now, of course, then comes this next level, which is people's ability to transcend all of that, the biological attractiveness to find other things attractive, like intelligence.
Of course.
Like the ability to have a good conversation with someone. Like the ability to explore a thought together can be a tremendous turn on.
Of course, and we all know beautiful people whom we looked at and we thought, oh my goodness, that person is so good looking. And then once they started to speak, we felt not at all attracted to them because it's not all in the looks. And also, Armand, I think we said this many times, but let me just repeat that when we walk in a room, we give off signals that we're not aware of that are immediately picked up through scent by the nose of the people in that room. And I'm not talking about something that we can actually smell. I'm talking about messages that reach the subconscious only. Mm-hmm. But the chemistry that we carry around, for instance, did you know that we carry 3 pounds of bacteria in our intestines, Armand?
3 pounds.
3 pounds. Do you know how many bacteria, how much bacteria that is? So, for instance, depending on what kind of bacteria we carry, we're going to have a certain chemistry. And so the molecules of scent that we put out as we walk around reach the nose of other people. And they respond to us without even knowing why they do, but because they have inhaled one of those molecules, and that molecule has communicated something about us that matches in some way their own chemistry soup, so that they are already somewhere in their brains, they know that they have a potential match here.
You know, for years, people have been trying to develop scents, perfumes, even if they're unconscious perfumes, things you can smell, to try to attract someone else by fooling them. Where is it in the human body that is the mastermind of all this? Get this. Although the reproductive parts, right, and I'm talking about breasts and hips and genitals and all that stuff, are often ascribed the credit or blame for human sexual attraction, what really takes place is that sexual attraction begins in a pea-sized structure called the hypothalamus.
Doesn't it all begin there, Armand?
In the good old hypothalamus.
Doesn't everything begin there?
So here we have this tiny, tiny, tiny little place in the human brain. Tiny bundle of nerves sets up an exciting chain of events when one person perceives another to be sexually attractive. the hypothalamus instantly notifies the pituitary gland.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And, you know, the pituitary gland
is called the master gland because it controls all of the others. All of the endocrine system is controlled by the pituitary.
And so it sends out the hormone. It becomes the hormone master or mistress. It says, so there we get the hypothalamus sends a message. Oops, hey, pituitary, wake up.
Once the pituitary is awakened, all of the other endocrine glands will respond according to what the pituitary says. And so there's going to be a flood of hormones, including, of course, the sex hormones, but also adrenaline, norepinephrine, dopamine, serotonin. There's going to be a lot of tuning up.
There it is. Hypothalamus talks to
the pituitary.
Pituitary starts sending out things like estrogen, progesterone, testosterone. Within seconds, the heart's pounding, the muscles are tense. He or she starts feeling a little dizzy, lightheaded. The room starts spinning, and you feel this tingling of sexual arousal. This chemical-driven anxiety and pining, this mood, which will swing from omnipotence and optimism to anxiety, it's crazy. It's like such an amazing thing that happens. A malfunctioning hypothalamus can have bizarre effects on one's romantic love life. Have you ever wondered why you're not so good at love? Maybe it's a hypothalamus. Irrational and distorted romantic choices, obsessions, idealization, a separation anxiety. Now, obsessional love is sometimes the effect of a dysfunction of the hypothalamus. It could be a tumor.
Sure, or it could be a chemical imbalance. It could be a number of things. But it's interesting to think that when people think of themselves as romance addicts or sex addicts, or you know, when they think of themselves as unable to control these urges, and when they are so filled with shame and guilt about that, maybe they should look at the fact that, you know, it's something that starts in the brain, and it's an imbalance, and perhaps it's not that they're bad people or it's not that they're weak. It's just that there is something in the brain that is not balanced, and it can be addressed in some way.
And it may not be you may not be able to address it.
Right.
Because some of these things, like, you know, we've known people who have had hormonal kind of things created, like migraines from hormones and stuff like that, where they try to correct it by giving you injections of estrogen and stuff. It doesn't work.
Of course, yes, it doesn't always work.
So it doesn't work. So if a man is oversexed, you don't give him estrogen, or it's not going to necessarily work. Or if a woman is totally, you can't necessarily give a testosterone to make your balance go back. But it is a consideration. It's a consideration that part of our development as humans is to include pituitary, hypothalamus, things that are at work. And it's important to understand this is not just your mind that is working, but your body is very involved. Now, we are able to override our minds. If a person would just respond to their biological imperatives, there would be no discretion used. But we could override it. We humans, we adults, we have very strong brains, and we can work with it in many ways.
But you know, Armand, I'll tell you after the break.
Yeah, we have to take a short break, Roberta. I'm sorry to interrupt. We're going to have to take a short break, my friends, and when we come back, we're going to play a little music, and then when we come back after that, we are going to continue with this. May even tell you a fascinating, wonderful, exciting story from mythology. We'll be back with you in just a couple of seconds.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
All right. Start bringing up your music now. kiss, please.
Thank you.
This is DJ Crush you're listening to, K-R-U-S-H, with Toshinori Kondo, doing a popular, I think it's a reggae tune, Sun is Shining. This is Armand DeMille with you with the Positive Mind. It is WBAI 99.5 FM. We are with Roberta Achi, who, if you're listening to this today, you may be listening in the future, is with us. On this Saturday, October 9th, you'll be at Sufi Books, won't you?
Yes, I'm doing a workshop. I'm going to be talking about nutrition and creativity.
Good. That's what we need. Certainly need creativity when we're dealing with, for those of you who just tuned in, the conflict about what we think and what love is and what sexuality is. Dr. Melvin Connor, K-O-N-N-E-R, Department of Anthropology, Emory University in Atlanta, talks about jealousy. Now get this, don't you think jealousy has got to be a human thing or it's got to be a primitive thing? He says that jealousy is an important part of the evolutionary programming for human beings. He says because sexual passion breeds wariness. The males aware of male competition for the potential mates, for females awareness of possible harm by an unwelcome male. So anyway, early in human history, males who did not react jealously to their mates had their mates stray. Now this is interesting. Because when the mate would stray, what they would do is they would have sex with someone else and come back and he'd have to bring up those children as well. So jealousy was very important to preserve.
Well, yes, and I can understand that. Although once I was on a plane and I saw a documentary of people in South America, some of the last, probably one of the last true hunter-gatherer societies, a tribe of maybe 30, 50 people at the most, and one of the last matrilineal societies. And it was interesting because they have the custom of polyandry, where the woman is allowed to have more than one husband, and it seemed to work in an amazingly well, Armand, because what happened was the woman, as a young woman, would be given to a husband, and then they would make their own hut, and they would have a baby or two, and then she may decide that she wants to take another husband, and she does that, and now she's going to have a baby with the second man, and what happens is the first husband is the one now who gets the advantage by the second marriage, whereby he doesn't have to go out and hunt anymore. He remains at home with the wife, and he helps with all the children, his own as well as the other men's husband, other men's. And the second one is the one that goes out hunting. And this works rather well for the children, for the men, for the women. It seems like a peaceful society. And I was fascinated by the fact that there was no jealousy whatsoever. In fact, the two husbands, or sometimes three, or sometimes even more, depending on what the woman feels like, it's up to her. They get along fine, and they help each other. And in the end, when you look at how the children are raised by not just the women, but by the men as well, because the first husbands get to stay home with the children get a great advantage. So I don't think that it's always been that way, that jealousy is, you know, I can see the evolutionary meaning of it, and I can see why it's important and why it has in some ways enhanced selection, and it is a well-known aphrodisiac, for instance.
Jealousy is,
yes.
What do you mean by a well-known aphrodisiac? I mean, it seems that the more a woman is in love, the more jealous she gets.
Right.
The more a man is in love, the more jealousy.
I think that that's true for both.
Stimulate?
And I think that what has been found is that when a person is afraid that the mate may be more interested in someone else, well, it brings up perhaps a sense of insecurity and a sense of possible loss, so a sense of anxiety that in some way is makes that person more interested in the partner. Maybe it works like that for competitive individuals, maybe not for everyone. I know people who cannot stand jealousy at all, and that just can't stand to be in a relationship where there is any threat. But for other people, it's not only tolerable, but it enhances their interest.
It's a strange thing. Yesterday I was watching a movie filmed in Jamaica called Rockers, and it was the most fascinating film, because in this film, the males, the men, who are the fathers of the children and supposedly the husbands, are would go off at will, and when they said, "When will you be back?" the answer would be, "I don't know." And it is very possible that when they went off, they would find another home and another family and not come back. And that seemed to be part of what worked as well. It's such a funny thing. It kind of worked. It kind of put a sense of responsibility in there. It's a fascinating film, by the way. Have you seen that film?
No.
Called Rockers? Oh, it's an amazing, amazing movie. Let's go back. We're talking about sexuality. We're talking about attraction. What is this need to cuddle? You know what I mean? Now, here's an interesting thing. You were talking about why would holding somebody be such an important part of love? Now, doesn't that sound obvious? Most people would say because it feels nice. This has nothing to do with hormones. This has nothing to do with anything.
Yes, there is a hormone actually that has been associated with the cuddling, and that's oxytocin. And because women have more than men, seems that they like to cuddle more than men, or they have a need to cuddle more than men. It seems that this hormone gives the person a desire to be close physically to their mate, and that that's what was observed. Now, prolactin is a hormone that does something interesting. It seems to decrease the desire for sex. Prolactin is the hormone that is responsible for producing milk in lactating women. And it seems to be produced by both men and women. And when it's too high in men, for instance, it can cause impotence.
Wow.
Yeah. And in women, it also can cause a decrease of sexual interest, I'd say.
Well, that would make sense, because then when a woman is breastfeeding, it would, biologically, it would diminish her sexual desire. Is that probably where the idea is?
Right, but, well, but not the desire to cuddle, not the right. desire to be close to her mate. See, I don't understand when you said the where the men leaves, that it makes sense. I don't know how a woman could possibly make sense out of the men leaving and feel that that is okay. I think that maybe she feels that she has no control over it. But for her, I think for a woman, the idea that of the possibility of her mate leaving, especially if she has a child, is terrifying. It's not.
Let's think about wolves for a minute.
Wolves mate for a lifetime.
Right. So now you got it. You got Mama Wolf is at home with Baby Wolf.
Right.
Let's say, and Daddy Wolf goes out hunting. Daddy Wolf could get killed.
Actually, with wolves, it's not like that. With wolves, they have a babysitter. They have like an older sibling, usually a female, who stays with all the pups.
Anti-wolf. You have anti-wolf, and you have...
Anti-wolf, yes. She stays with all the pups, and mother and father go out hunting.
Okay, but let's say, in nature, there must be a thing where the female baby nursing, and the male goes out and gets killed, the female somehow has to deal with that.
Oh, well, of course. But I think that it's very threatening to a young female to think of that possibility.
I'll make you bet what happens to the young female.
What happens?
She grows male. I'll bet what she does. No, I'm serious about this. I think what would happen if you're suddenly abandoned.
Oh, you mean that you develop more of your masculine?
Male character?
Sure.
Absolutely.
No, I agree with you.
Testosterone will come in.
I agree
with
you.
It's like plants who can't find female plants who can't find a male plant anywhere around will grow male parts.
Yes.
So
absolutely.
there is a way for that to happen.
Yes.
Abandonment has got its compensations in the body. We fear it, we think it's terrible, we think it's horrible, but people get by. Kind of an interesting thing. So let's go on a little further. Now I want to go back to what we were saying about this. The need, biological need, for a woman, and I'll say woman because it's mostly a woman thing, to cuddle during sex or after sex, to be close afterwards, reflects her programmed need for protection and care should a child be born from this event. So the oxytocin that is secreted that makes her want to just hold and be held. People listen to this, and I'm saying, whoever you are, if you love a woman and make love to a woman, her need to be held is very big. They will talk themselves, you may be able to talk them out of it and say, let's go for pizza. But that feeling is an almost biological imperative, and when you interrupt it, you interrupt the chemistry.
Oh, absolutely, yes. See, I think that that's also what happens with jealousy and doubt. I think that it is an aphrodisiac up to a point, and then there comes a point where it actually breaks completely the desire for the other, and it becomes, or even like the when men don't understand the part about the cuddling, they don't understand that by not offering that opportunity to their mates, they are decreasing the attraction that their mates feel, because without that, the woman no longer feels secure in that relationship. And insecurity can be an enhancement of sexual attraction, desire, etc., up to a point. Then there comes a point where it actually becomes the opposite. And usually when a couple reaches that point, things become very difficult to restore.
Okay, let's break that down, Roberta. You said a lot in that sentence. It is possible that you know, do it and leave could make somebody feel stimulated and more attracted because they could hunger for you.
But
after a period of time, they will lose connection with you.
It's possible, because I think that insecurity, jealousy, and all these things that, you know, to a certain extent, people like to play this kind of game with one another, whereby they know that if they make their mate a little more insecure, a little bit worrying, you know, that it can be an enhancer and it can be stimulating. But you're kind of playing with fire there, because yes, it can be, but then there's also the case whereby it becomes the opposite and it turns a person off. Because when I think there's another thing to be said about pain, love seems to always, or for most people, entail some degree of discomfort, whether that be physical, emotional, spiritual, mental. There's some discomfort. Armand, I don't know if you can confirm that, but in my experience and observation, it seems that whenever a person is in love, some aspect of that love hurts, whether it's the doubt, whether it's even just the fact that you know that someday this love is going to end, because life eventually ends. So to some extent, love and pain go together, because it's just part of it. But then attraction that's based on causing a person to suffer is a double-edged sword, and sometimes it does the opposite of what that person may intend for it to do.
Well, you know, what's really important is if we think about the hypothalamus and the pituitary.
Right.
Did we leave out the amygdala?
How could we? No, I didn't. I did actually mention it earlier on in the program, because the amygdala is the center of all these basic emotions and instincts. So the amygdala is a big part. Did I ever tell you that I wanted to call my daughter Amygdala?
Yeah, I know you
Armand?
Did.
Isn't that a great name?
It is a great name.
But anyway, yes, all of the instinctual aspects of attraction are there for humans as they are for animals. And in fact, for humans, they're even more specialized. And there's more ways to attract and to enjoy that aspect of love, the attractive aspect of love for humans. And we are very good at attracting and being attractive.
You know, I was thinking about the Three Stooges. There's Pithy, Hypo, and Amy, in this case, and these are the hypothalamus, the pituitary, and the amygdala. You got your own Three Stooges up there, friends. And now here's the secret of the Three Stooges, which is very important. Actually, Stooges, because it's dumb. You know, it's like that's the characterization of it. What happens is you fall in love, but then something and it's happened to every one of you. You could fall out of love just as fast.
Yes, that does happen.
It's happened to almost everyone. It's happened to couples who are married. You're in love, you're married, you're living with each other, you feel terrific. It could happen with a romance. And then all of a sudden you feel...
It's gone.
It is gone.
Yeah.
Then what's the it that's gone?
Yeah.
All the stuff we talked about. The oxycontin,
something happens to the brain.
The hormones. So this little pea-sized controller in our brain, the pituitary gland, the hypothalamus, the amygdala, they could turn the switch off. It could be a behavior that you do. It could be very often people who are caught cheating on their mates. The mates very often will have this switch go off. That's it. And the hypothalamus says, too much risk, it's over.
Yes.
Many people don't have that reaction. But it is possible, we should know, that as much as this is easy to turn on, it could be turned off fast. One of the things that turned it off is the what you were saying, the absence of bonding. If you don't hold, if you don't touch, if you don't make contact, if you don't exchange pheromones, smells, if you don't feel your skin against the other person's skin, that's why I'm always worried about people who don't sleep in the same bed, you know, and people who sleep in separate rooms.
Right.
Or people who bathe themselves so much that they can't even get anywhere near the other person.
Right.
It is very important to understand that the way our bodies are built, we could just as fast turn off as turn on. Now, this is why I think the death of a mate, the absence of a mate or abandonment is survivable, because the switch could get turned off.
Yes, and we also know that it can kill.
That's right.
There are people who just, once they lose that love, they can't recover a sense of self that is functional enough. And it's not something that the intellect even seems to have access to. It's not something that can be cured or can be, there are no words that can reach that part that is not able to survive the abandonment. And some people do just fade away.
Some people die,
yes.
They just say, that's it. You know?
Well, they don't say that, but I think that their bodies, when you withdraw the company of a mate, especially if you've been with them for a long time, the difference in chemistry when you take away that element that was there for a long time is such that that person cannot readjust, and that does happen too.
And doesn't want to readjust, because part of what readjusting may be is a depression,
right.
A sinking feeling, and you
might
just say, hey, you know, I've got here this far, I don't want to go any further.
Right.
And many people you'll find die right after their partners do.
Sure.
So as dizzying, as exciting, as the roller coaster ride of being in love is, it is also exhausting, stressful, and as this new, as the infatuation wanes, a new chemical is produced in our brains to take over, and this, like, this high that we had is replaced, you know, this amphetamine-like high we have is replaced by opiates. By opiate-like, because the opiates help us calm down, settle in, and get comfortable. Even if the relationship has its flaws, the endorphins, you know, produced by the warmth, trust, stability, friendship, and affection keeps the partners close.
Right.
The sexual stimulation may not be there, but there is a replacement. So where one chemical goes out the window, you know, where the amphetamine-like high disappears, the morphine-like high comes in. So is this all chemical?
There's something to be said for the person who likes that amphetamine-like high, the phase of excitement where one is energized and very focused and hyper vigilant. And, you know, I know people who can get addicted to that stage, and once that fades out of the relationship and they settle into a phase that's more endorphin-like, more relaxed and, you know, without all the tension of the doubt and the jealousy or the chase and the thrill and the risk involved with the beginning of the relationship, once that's lost and they settle into the calmness of it, it's just not enough. There's not enough stimulus. There's not enough excitement. And it dies out simply because the chemistry that supported that attraction was based on the excitatory neurotransmitters as opposed to the sedatives.
Yeah, and, you know, it might be that a person survived a very stressful childhood by being always maintaining a vigilance,
sure,
a hyper-excitement.
Right.
So now if you don't have that hyper-excitement and you slide into this morphine-like relaxation, you may not be able to take it. And then that's where fidelity may go out the window.
Right.
A person may say, I got to get charged.
Right.
I got to feel the thrill. I can't settle down. Roberta, we're out of time. In fact, Michael, thank you very much. We're running a little over. We apologize. If you want a copy of today's program or any of the early series that we did on the evolution of human sexuality, the evolution of man as seen through human sexuality, you would call 212-757-4488. Roberta's workshop, October 9th, Saturday from 11 to 2 at Sufi, S-U-F-I Books.
It's this Saturday?
It's this Saturday. Such good people, those Sufi people. The Sufi Books people. I like
yes,
them
they
a
are.
Lot.
Yes.
And the website, thepositivemind.com. We have to be going. I'm sorry. Be back with you tomorrow, my friends, at 1 p.m. Roberta, thanks again.
Thank you, Armand.
Yeah, looking forward to the next shows we're doing, huh? Exciting stuff coming up.
Mm-hmm.